House Labor Committee, April 26, 8:30 a.m. here in room D, tape 118.
And I think the first thing on the agenda is House Bill 3018. And we can't make any decisions, but we can
talk about it a little bit.
Do we have anybody signed up on it? We're just going to do a work session.
I'll explain. House Bill 3018, to refresh your memory, is the plumbing continuing education bill. And we have testimony, I guess. In any event, you guys talked about this at length last time. The plumbers are have agreed to pay a $25 renewal fee to offset the administrative costs of the continuing education. You have a fiscal in front of you that says $42,000, but it's calculated with the number of plumbers. If they pay this renewal fee, it'll almost perfectly offset. In fact, I think it's a little bit more. In any event, this is what's back for you.
You need to set it down to Ways and Means.
Well, I think it's going to be a zero when the fiscal comes back for the amendments.
It will be.
Yeah.
Zero.
So, but we don't have the actual fiscal.
We have Michael Diddy. Sorry, we don't have a better audience for you.
Well,
good morning, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for coming.
Good to see you again. Basically, my testimony is a matter of record, and I just wanted to come today to show my support once again, and if there's anything I could answer, I just would like to remind you that I represent IAPMO, the International Association of Plumbing and Mechanical Officials, our Cascade chapter, and also non-union contractors, and to tell you that we have, since our last meeting, had quite a bit of signing up on the sheets to show how many journeyman plumbers we had that were supported. And
Mike, would you want to just say who you are, the microphone for a record?
I'm Michael Diddy, and I'm representing the International Association of Plumbing and Mechanical Officials. I'm the Education Committee Chairman for that Cascade chapter.
Thank you.
And also non-union contractors. I work for Mechanical Systems Incorporated in Beaverton as a commercial estimator.
Okay.
And to say that I found that since our last meeting, and I've been handing out sign-up sheets to have people show their support, that I've been amazed at the amount of support we do have.
Good.
And if there's any questions that I can help with, just feel free.
Any questions for Michael? Jim, do you have something you'd want to add?
Well, my name's Gary Wright, and I represent
okay.
myself and Local 290, the plumbers and pipe fitters, and we're in support of the House Bill 3018 as amended, and just pretty much ditto to what Mike said. Now, you know, from talking to plumbers out in the industry, we've got quite a bit of support that they're willing to pay the extra money to get the certification and training program in place. And any questions that you might have?
Any questions for Jim? Again, I'd like to thank both of you for coming today and helping us.
I would like to say we had a board meeting last Thursday night. And one of the things that we are setting up right now is to expand our seminars for more statewide seminars. And so we have something going right now that would be able to be an improved training hours and courses, so that we are working towards that end.
Okay. Thank you again, both. We have Don Woodley. I'm going to stop for a second, and we're going to call the meeting to order now that we have a quorum.
Just in time for me.
Yes.
Good morning. My name is Don Woodley. I'm building official for Marion County. I'm representing the Oregon Building Officials Association. Originally, we were in opposition to this bill. Not that we don't think that continuing education is a good deal. Needless to say, our staff is in school all year long for different things. We do support it. The concern we had with the bill was for the funding source, the continuing education funding. Presently, there is a 1% surcharge put on all building permits for the purpose of training building inspectors. And we didn't want to see this money distributed any farther, if you will, for training of plumbers. We would wanted them to be able to support their own program. In talking to Gary Wright just this morning, he has told me about the amendment that's been offered to fund their own continuing education, and with that, we would go on the record as strongly supporting this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Don. Is there any questions for Don?
That's right. Okay. That's right. He's got
Thank you for Thank coming you. And testifying. See Jim Rogers.
I don't want any more blood.
Jim, thank you for coming today.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jim Rogers. I'm a retired plumbing inspector for the County of Clackamas. I am the code advisor chairman for the IAPMO, that is the International Association of Plumbing and Mechanical Officials, and I'm here today to give my support to this House Bill 3018. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you might want to ask concerning this. We solely support the bill. And that, I guess that's the would be the extent of my testimony, unless indeed you had some questions you'd like to ask.
Any questions for Jim? Thank you very much for testifying.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to go into work session on 3018, and we have some amendments that have been proposed to eliminate us sending this bill down to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, let's move the Dash 1 amendments.
Yes.
Are they called Dash 1?
Not yet. Sam,
okay, we'll call them the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay.
The amendments that say, I don't know, is there any identifying mark on this?
It's 64T in the left-hand corner.
Yeah, they're just the only proposed amendments,
okay.
Frankly.
I would move these amendments.
Yeah. The amendments read, for the record, for continuing education for renewing the certificate of competency, $25, which is added under ORS 693 for plumber's fees.
Okay, so it adds $25, which removes the cost. Is there any objections to the amendments? Okay,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If we can, I would move House Bill 3018 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay, any discussion on the motion? Do you want to call the roll, please?
Representative Dominic?
Aye.
Representative Edmondson?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Manis?
Aye.
Representative Repine? Representative Watt?
Aye.
Representative Dorfler?
Aye. Okay. Carrie, John, would you carry this one, please? Thank you. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2775.
Gentlemen, House Bill 2775 is your wage claim bill. Last time you heard it in conjunction with 2979, and I believe that Representative Johnson and Representative Repine drafted some amendments to this bill to take in all concerns. Basically, what their amendments would do would require that wages be paid immediately when an employer discharges an employee under the following circumstances. If the employee's worked less than 90 days and is a seasonal farm worker or worker in the construction industry, an employment agreement has been terminated pursuant to a written and definite contract. The employer and employee agree to a termination date that is no more than 2 days later than the date than their agreement, and the employment is terminated pursuant to the federal WARN statute. Also, unless an employee has given 48 hours notice to quit, the final wages are due and payable in 10 days, excluding weekends and holidays, or the next regular payday, whichever is first. Furthermore, if an employee is discharged for any reason not outlined above in Section 1, which would require immediate wages, the wages are due and payable within 48 hours, excluding weekends and holidays. And finally, if the employment is terminated for any reason on a weekend or a holiday, then immediately is defined as not later than the second business day after employment termination. Section 2 of the bill is from the original bill, which clarifies the date, and I'd just like to point out for your consideration, within the original bill on the hand-engrossed version, on page 1, I'm not sure, perhaps yeah. You did intend, and Representative Johnson, it was just pointed out, subparagraph 2 under section 1, did you intend to delete that?
I'm sorry, he's found some humorous on another bill.
Okay.
I want to grab every bit of humor I can find in this process, so I hate this one.
if you intended to delete this part here. I mean, that's what the amendments say, actually. I think maybe, you know, this is what you intended, but the draft one amendments came back from OC.
I don't remember ever saying that.
So maybe you
want to
consider that.
Okay, everybody understands the amendments?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
What we're doing is specifying the circumstances when they are due and payable immediately, which is where we're being precise, and then we're allowing the wages are generally due. I'm trying to pick up the time immediately, but then we say that doesn't include Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays. It's really the second business day after the employment termination. Is there a general standard here for when wages will be due and payable when all these specific exceptions don't apply?
Mr. Johnson, you worked on amendments. Can you answer
the question again?
Is there a general provision somewhere as to when the wages are due when these specific exceptions don't apply?
Yeah, that's paragraph three. Actually two or three. Because if
48
they,
hours.
If Section 1 doesn't apply because they quit, then Section 2 applies. If Section 1 doesn't apply because the employer discharges them for any reason other than the circumstances in number 1, then Section 3 applies. In essence, the concept is that if they quit without notice, they just don't show up, then the employer should be able to pay them in essence the ordinary course, the regular payday. If the employer, on the other hand, is the one that brings the termination about and didn't get into cause or any other specifications of why, but just for any reason, and I was just writing a section here, I think we need to make it clear that Section 3 applies to any reason other. If the employer, you get into chicken and egg, if a person doesn't show up for work, has he quit without notice under Section 2, or if the employer then replaces that position because the guy hasn't showed up, has the employer then discharged him under Section 3? And I think we need to make it clear that if the employer takes action to terminate the employment because the employee has failed to show up without notice, then provisions of Section 3 apply. And you could say that under that circumstance, Section 2 applies if that happens. If under any circumstance, if an employee quits without notice or doesn't show up, without quitting with notice, then the regular payday or 10 days thing kicks in. If, on the other hand, the employer discharges the employee for any reason other than the enumerated ones in Section 1 or the employee's failure to show up for work or quitting without notice, whatever, then the 48 hours would kick in.
Mr. Chairman, it would seem that the failure to give notice is already covered in the sense the employer, by work rules, can define how far along you'll be when, if you didn't show up for work and you don't give any notice, that that's considered quitting your job. If the employer, by work rules, says in a construction job, it might be you don't show up any day and you don't give any notice that you've quit your job. On the other hand, in some other long-term employment, might say if you fail to show up for 3 days without notice, you've quit your job. You could probably leave it to the employer to define by work rules when failure to give notice and failure to show up together constitutes having just quit the job without notice. I don't know if you need to kick in some special provision here to do that.
Yeah, this is, it was all just kind of rough draft. This bill came up in front of us and we had a bunch of ideas were thrown around. I just was given the task of putting them down on some paper as a discussion point. So,
are these exceptions built in because of the concerns from Oregon Legal Services about seasonal workers and people out in the field, so to speak?
Right. There was, we had contrary type concerns with the current statute and the current proposal to change the current statute. One concern initially was the State Fair people. Remember, they had people who were ending their employment on Saturday night, and they had the people that pay the checks didn't come to work until Monday or Tuesday. And that was one concern. On the other hand, we didn't want to. There were circumstances that I tried to list in Section 1 that seem to be circumstances under which immediate payment is reasonable and is justifiable and necessary. So if anybody has any other specific circumstances which they believe immediate payment is proper, then we need to just go ahead and put those in Section 1. And then, by definition, all other circumstances follow either into a quit with notice or a quit without notice or a discharge. You know, I mean, somebody is beating up on a fellow employee and the employer comes along and fires him, that's maybe a circumstance that isn't covered by, you know, immediate payment, because in that circumstance maybe it's reasonable to give the employer a couple of days to get the check. And that's the 48-hour provision in Section 3. We retained in Section 1, we retained the, I'm sorry, let me take that back. In Section 2, we retained the immediate payment if an employee gives 48 hours ahead of time of his intention, his or her intention.
So I'm working, may I, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
I'm working for someone. I give 2 days' notice. That means when I'm finished, they've got to have my check.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's current law, and we're not trying to change that.
Thanks, sir. Okay. Go ahead.
I still have a question. In the definition of, well, what you're calling here under B, where it says the employment agreement has been terminated, where there's an agreement between, where the employment agreement has been terminated pursuant to a written definite contract. What can be in that contract? Can it go beyond 48 hours? Can it be a month or any set time that is written in the contract?
What I was trying to capture there is any time that the person begins an employment saying, I'm hiring you for the next month, and at the end of the month on the 30th, you're termination's over, it's reasonable for the employer to have a check for him when he's done on the 30th, instead of making that person wait until a couple days into the next month to get his check.
So, Representative
Donald, Mr. Chair and Rod, so what you're saying is that every employer in the state can get around this law by just having a written agreement at the time they hire someone.
Mr. Chair,
no, I don't think that was in. If they have a written agreement, and
I'm saying every employer in the state could have a written agreement, and all it takes is for every employer in the state to have a written agreement that says that you will not get paid until the 30th.
No,
and then
no.
The
if their employment, the actual employment, not the payment date, but just the job. I mean, they're hired for a job, 6 months, a year, whatever. If any time they have an agreement that the person is only going to get a job for a week or a month or whatever, and at the end of that week or month, it's reasonable for the employer to have a check ready for him instead of making the person wait a couple of days after the, you know, after the ending date has occurred.
Mr. Chairman,
that's what we're trying to do in that section.
Go ahead.
There's a separate law that requires that paychecks be issued on a routine basis. I think it's no more than every 2 weeks or twice a month. This doesn't change that law. So you can't get around that law by having a written agreement. You gentlemen seem to be looking at this from two different perspectives. What Representative Johnson seems to be getting at is that if you have a written agreement that you're working for 30 days and you're to be paid, the employer can't get around this by saying, well, gee, I'm now telling you that the contract's up, I'll pay you in 2 days. Instead, he's taking a proactive approach that with that contract, you have to pay the very minute you're finished rather than waiting. It's not an end run to allow him to extend the time, but it's to require him to pay right away in those situations. That's
right.
The way I understand it.
Right, and that is current law. I just reworded it a little bit. And if you look at lines I guess it's not current law. It was in the bill. I'm sorry. I think it is current law. Let me find the words. lines 14 and 15, where the current law says, when any such employee not having a contract for a definite period shall quit employment, and he has to give 48 hours notice. And the implication there is that if he has a contract for a definite time, then he doesn't have to give 48 hours notice in order to get paid immediately on termination. The idea is that if you agree, if both parties agree that at 5 o'clock on Thursday your job's over, then at 5 o'clock on Thursday the employer ought to have a check for him. That's all.
Okay, let's have Emil Cedarlight.
Emily. Good morning. I'm Emily Cedarleaf, representing Multifamily Housing Council, both as an industry and as an employer. In an effort to keep rents from spiraling and in order to affect economies of scale, many of the property management firms are beginning to regionalize and centralize, many of them not located in the state of Oregon. They have seen fit to invest in management in Oregon, but their offices are many times in Texas or Arizona, California, or Washington. Over the years, I've been hearing an increasing amount of problems whereby they either terminate the employee for theft or misuse of funds, or the employee quits with no notice, and they have had a spiraling increase in payroll costs, attempting to get payrolls faxed to payroll services or get checks cut and then having to FedEx them into the state. I recently had a similar problem whereby in January I scheduled a time off going to Chicago to visit my parents. I had left an employee staff of 7. Payroll had just been completed. I was anticipating to be out of the state for 2 weeks. Simultaneously, the officers that were also signatories on the checking account were out of the state also. I had an employee who quit with no notice, giving us a written letter, leaving it on her desk with all of her keys and credit cards and saying goodbye. I was in Chicago. Yes, we have a payroll service. Yes, they were able to execute the check, but the signatories to that account were not available. However, all of us had plans, so we were in between payroll periods, and we shouldn't have had a problem. We dealt with that long distance, trying to take care of the problem. And I was offended with some of the testimony that was given to you last time that said, if it ain't fixed, if it's not broken, don't fix it. I'm telling you, it's broken, and we're the many ones that have to deal with it, including myself. Also given to you in testimony last time by the Bureau of Labor and Industry staff was that landlords, when they find out that people aren't employed, have a tendency not to extend credit, not to work with the system. And I'm telling you that I represent landlords, and they don't go around daily to determine who's employed and who's not, whether giving notices. They give notices on the timely basis because the law allows them to do it. As to the amendments that you've been introduced, I agree with the subsection 1 provisions about seasonal workers. However, I'm totally confused on section 2 again. In my case, where the employee quit with notice, taking effect immediately, would she still have to have her check in 48 hours? Employees who are paid on a regular basis are used to getting those checks on a regular basis. Why they should have to then totally disrupt a system in order to get their checks immediately was beyond me. I believe that they ought to get it on the next regular payday when they've given such a notice and when they've already disrupted business in the manner that they quit. So I can support the amendments as to 1. I question number 2, and I'd also like to be able to understand how it would have affected me when sub 2 says if a notice is not given to the employer. She gave the notice. It said effective immediately. I'm open for questions.
Mr. Chairman, go ahead. One of the things we need to remember is that we still have employment at will in Oregon. Employment at will is a two-edged sword. It means that the employer can get rid of somebody at will unless there's a contractual provision otherwise, or unless we have some statute that, for instance, discrimination would be inappropriate. The employee also has the capability to leave that relationship immediately. I might mention historically that we forget that employment at will is also a benefit to employees because we're no longer in the days of peonage, and somebody could be forced to remain in someone's employment or even in slavery. Don't always put this stuff in historical context. It is a two-way street. But with that employment at will, the employer wants to have the opportunity to tell someone, take a walk, your job is over. The employer is in control in that situation, and we've tried to propose some restrictions here. Well, the employee is also able to say, I'm going to take a walk, I want to leave. But there's a string attached there. And what we're trying to do here is to make sure that the employee is given as much opportunity to get that check within reason. Now, what I'm gathering from your testimony is that you accept the notion that there ought to be some reasonable provision for payment. But say if you've got a two-week pay period, and on Monday morning of the new two-week pay period, someone gives you 2 days' notice and says, I quit. Do you think it's really reasonable to require that person to wait till the end of that two-week pay period to get their paycheck?
I do, because, Representative Mannix, because they've already known that their paydays were on a regular two-week basis. If they quit, they are disrupting a business in a manner that causes chaos. Now, if I fire them, I have no problem giving them a check immediately. And in many cases where I have fired someone, I've even given them 2 weeks' pay in lieu of 2 weeks' notice. But when they quit and totally disrupt the business, I have difficulty understanding why they should further disrupt it, trying to get their paycheck immediately or within 48 hours.
Is there an industry standard now of, I mean, in my profession, it's generally considered for non-lawyers the 2 weeks' notice is appropriate, and then for lawyers to be professional about leaving work, someone ought to have 30 days' notice, just as a matter of what I call standards of practice. It's not in the law or anything. Is there any given routine in terms of a permanent employee as to how much notice they're usually given when they're fired?
Representative Mannix, for our industry, we normally don't want to terminate employees that are good, hardworking employees. Normally, when we're terminating employees, it's for misuse of funds or improper behavior on a rental property. And in that case, many times I've known of them either giving, they give the pay immediately, but many of them will give a period of time for the manager to move off the property, being anywhere from 72 hours to 2 weeks to a month. So they're not only getting their pay, their occupancy is ceasing, and that many times they don't pay the rent for that period of time while they're no longer employed. They're still on the property.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. David Neville?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I'm David Neville. I work for Oregon Legal Services. It's a statewide organization that represents many low-income farm workers. I've previously submitted testimony in writing, and I won't read that testimony, but I wanted to reiterate some testimony that you heard last time on this bill, that immediate payment of farm workers is especially important. We would be in opposition to House Bill 2775 due to its effect on farm workers, and we're generally opposed to any dilution in the prompt payment provisions that are now in Oregon law. Farm workers are employed for short periods of time. They must move quickly when employment ends, both to maintain income and to secure housing.
Mr. Neble?
Yes.
If I can interrupt you, you said that they're employed for short periods of time. Approximately how long are they employed on average?
I think it varies from crop to crop, but I think the 90 days that is placed in the in your amendments and the proposed amendments would include most of the folks that I'm talking about. Okay.
And so, therefore, if they work for less than 90 days and they're a seasonal farm worker, they're entitled under these amendments to immediate payment.
That's correct, as defined in the bill.
That's provided for in these amendments. So.
That's right, and we're glad to see that the amendments showed sensitivity to that problem. I think that there is a problem that remains in payment when they quit without notice. I think that situation occurs fairly frequently, although I don't know how frequently, but in that situation they would have to wait until the next payday or 10 days, whichever is first, whichever is sooner, to get paid. And I think that many of these folks don't have a forwarding address to which the money could be sent, and I think that would cause a real problem for those farm workers.
If they quit.
If they quit without notice, if they quit without giving 48 hours notice, that's correct.
Go ahead. Are we driven in terms of trying to establish social legislation here by trying to anticipate socially irresponsible behavior by employers and employees? It seems to me that the socially responsible people are not the ones who run into problems here. It's socially irresponsible on both sides.
Representative Maddox, I think that that's correct, although I think that just given the dynamics of the seasonal farm worker force, these folks, I think, probably travel in groups, and work might end for one part of the group before it ends for another.
In other words, you've got 10 people, and five of them got laid off, and the other five are with them, and they can't hang around waiting for the... They've got to go somewhere where all 10 can be working.
Yeah, exactly. And I doubt, well, I'm not sure how, given the history of the labor relations and agriculture, I don't know how widespread the knowledge is that you're better off if you give 48 hours advance notice.
They're worried about being fired the moment they give 48 hours notice.
I would guess that's true.
What about carnival workers? We've heard testimony about the fairs, and the anticipation there is, of course, I guess that might be covered by a written contract that says your work ends at midnight Saturday. Is that your intention? Maybe I should ask Representative Johnson about
that. Right, and in that section, in that event, Section 4 kicks in, which says that if employment termination occurs on Saturday, Sunday, or holiday, payment... ...will start taking part in this. The... United Way Fund receipts from the state employee payroll system had gone down because these other organizations had been able to take part, and so they're competing now for those dollars. And so when we again think of the truly charitable kinds of people that we all as a total society would like to help, that effort is being hampered by these political organizations being able to take a cut out of these employees' paychecks. So in an era when the government funding for political and for charitable activities or for people in need is going down, both on the federal and state level, here we have a system where we're impacting the private nonprofit organization's ability to help those persons in need.
Okay, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If we're a... The only objection I really have, to be blunt with you, to any kind of a payroll deduction plan for various organizations is the cost that the state incurs in fulfilling the desires of individuals to have the deduction carried out. There may be some generic deductions such as contributions to a credit union account or paying your union dues or those kinds of things that sort of fit in the employment relationship. But for instance, as a private employer, if my employees came to me and said they wanted to have a payroll deduction to send money to XYZ charity, I'd say, fine, I'll find out how much it costs me to do that for you, and then you can pay, say, a dollar per paycheck to cover the cost, and for your convenience, we'll do that. You know, or I may, as a benevolent employer, just say, I'll just do it. But if there was a cost involved, I may well say, you pay the freight. Have you considered just saying... Instead of saying we're going to restrict all this and we don't like the payroll system being used as a vehicle for certain things, just saying, well, it's a pay-as-you-go kind of thing. Figure out a dollar or whatever the cost may be and round it up to a dollar and just say, if you're a charitable organization and you want to participate in the payroll deduction plan for the state of Oregon, we don't mind our employees giving to whomever they want to. I don't care whether it's a charitable organization or not, as a matter of fact, but... we'll charge you a dollar per paycheck for the expense of transmitting this money. And it's convenient for the employee, but the employees then pay for it.
I appreciate that thought. And if these political organizations were at least paying their way in this system, that would be better than what we have now. I'd suggest, though, that if we open that up, like you say, you don't care who it is, as long as they pay the freight, then you end up, you'd have... political parties, actual political parties, and who knows, maybe...
Well, what if I wanted to make a monthly contribution to the Democratic Party of Oregon or the Republican Party, but I was told, okay, you can do that, but for other than the standard things, credit unions and union dues and this kind of thing, you have to pay a dollar a paycheck, and you can designate anybody you want, up to 10 organizations or whatever, and we'll do it for you, but you're going to pay the freight. Wouldn't that, one, allow access, allow convenience, but two, make sure that the government is not subsidizing any kind of activity?
Well, like I said, that'd be better than subsidizing as we are now. But the one reality that you'd have to recognize is that the current, or historical at least, support for the charitable organizations would, like United Way, would suddenly United Way would have to be paying for a cut out of this when historically they haven't had to.
Well, the employee would pay.
Which is another.
The employee would pay.
Employee.
Well.
Dollar.
It's all semantics. I mean, if the employee decides he wants to contribute $100 to some organization and the top $5 goes out of it to pay for administrative costs or whatever, then the recipient only gets $95 or $99 or whatever the cost was, as opposed to $100. So either way you look at it, the true charitable organization would receive less under that scenario. And the other thing is, I illustrated the point with political parties, but it seems like if you add this thing up, make it that open, there'd be I'm trying to think of any, you know, just people off the street that want to get their name on some list, and you'd end up with a huge morass of various organizations, and no matter how small or how legitimate or whatever, and they're trying to get their cut out of the state employee's paycheck.
Yes.
But if your objection is the cost, it seems to me we can come up with a pay-as-you-go method to take care of costs. My objection might be to the favoritism of the current system, which favors charitable organizations. Maybe I do want to give my money to a political organization every month, but I'm willing to pay the freight. I could see philosophically why we'd say government shouldn't be subsidizing contributions. But if we eliminate the subsidy, and we could say too, we won't let anyone participate as an organization if they don't have at least 50 people who are designating them, some minimum number, so that you don't have to do a special deposit each month for one out of, say, 100,000 employees who designated them. You set some minimum number and say anyone who's got more than 50 people or 100 people designated, they want to pay a buck for the option of having a payroll deduction plan for charity and politics. In fact, it might be a moneymaker for state government. It might help pay for the payrolls.
Yeah, I think the thing that you got to remember is that the things that the charitable organizations do, for example, Salvation Army is there for somebody's hungry. Red Cross is there if somebody's house burns down. Those kinds of organizations are doing things that if they weren't there, government would be looked to do those things.
Can't we say the same?
And so to the extent that we allow or we subsidize charitable organizations in serving people in need, we're in essence ever so slightly paying for something we'd have to pay a lot more for if those charitable organizations weren't there to do the job in the first place.
And
that can't be said for these political organizations.
Do we allow contributions to churches?
I don't think so. If that's...
See, I would just as soon give money to the Catholic Church each month as to give it to United Way, and I think they do all kinds of wonderful things.
I think there's probably a separation of church and state issue there. I don't know.
Because of the subsidy.
Because of the involvement.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Edmondson and then Representative
Elmy. Representative Johnson, I hate this bill.
Thank you.
I hate it because it asks us, whether directly or indirectly, to favor one form of speech over another, whether it's a charity or an environmental group or a church or whatever. I think we're indirectly interfering with a person's right to give their money. And when my view is we either open the door or close it. But what you're proposing is to put a screen door on, which allows only certain deductions through and filters out others. And I can't help from reading the letters that have been submitted to suspect very strongly that this is a hit on environmental giving, that is basically a group of employers attempting to chill a form of free speech. And I know that, and I realize that there are general policies that are also present here, but I think that this is a thinly veiled attempt to chill the environmental movement in Oregon.
First off, three things. First off, I don't deny that the preservationists that are shutting down the timber industry and being supported in their fundraising efforts by the state of Oregon is the genesis of this bill. And that's, I'll admit
appreciate
that to
your
you.
Honesty.
And I, you know, I haven't denied that to anybody. But first off, it's not a free speech thing because the employee can contribute to any preservationist organization he or she wants to. And secondly, there is a legitimate reason for making a distinction between charitable organizations and political organizations. And that is, as I said before, charitable organizations are doing things that the government would have to do if they didn't do them. Political organizations
Wait,
are not.
I'm sorry, I don't want to get into a big argument over that, but I happen to believe that environmental groups are doing things that I think government should be doing, like protecting the wildlife of this planet and the people of this, which include the people of this planet. So I think that what you're trying to draw a distinction, which makes no difference to me, and I just want you to understand in front of God and everybody why I hate this bill. Okay? Enough said.
His vote explanation is now recorded. That's great.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, it will be recorded.
Yep.
Maybe not.
Mr. Chairman, Rod, a few weeks ago when we talked about this, I suggested that instead of trying to restrict the freedom of expression of some state employees, that maybe the direction would be to expand it to the Oregon Lands Coalition or to the Yellow Ribbon Coalition or some other coalition so that we have the same rights, because you and I agree on this issue probably a lot closer than Representative Edmondson and I do on this particular, on the issue of the environment. But I think that we're touching on freedom of speech and I guess of expression. And I guess the question that I have to go along with it, I just want to get my comment in there too. The question is, if this is going to save the state so much money, where's the impact statement that says how much money we're going to save by just restricting a few items? If we're going to do away with payroll checkoff completely, we could save some money. But if we're going to take one or two checkoffs off, how much is that going to save the state, and where's the impact statement about
well,
the big
if you
impact?
Recall, I told Representative Drifler that the cost savings, although there is obviously going to be some, if nothing less than the ink on the pen that signs the extra check, that if you limit the number of people here. That's not the point of the bill, and I'm not representing that there's huge savings by doing this. As I told him, and I tell you again, the idea here is that it's just not proper use of state monies to help these people raise money. If they're political organizations, if the Ku Klux Klan came in here and wanted the state of Oregon to help it raise money, what would we say? We'd say, you know what?
You might be surprised.
Yeah, well, I don't. You might be surprised at the color, at how colorful the language could get, but we wouldn't let that happen because we don't. We see their political aims as being something that's totally inappropriate for the state to be involved in. I use them as an illustration because just because, as Representative Edmonds says, he may support the political aims of some of these political organizations, doesn't make them any less political. And for us as a state to authorize state money to be used to help political organizations raise money is just not proper. We ought to just draw the line and say, if you're political, you don't participate, you go raise your own money, we'll help charitable organizations raise money, and that's it.
Well, just to follow up on that, I'm wondering if we're spending more money on this piece of legislation than we might save for the next 5 years.
Well,
that's going to be said on many.
So
careful on that one.
Yeah, the point I'm trying to make is I don't see the savings as being, if the issue is that you just don't want environmentalists to have checkoff, why didn't you just have a bill that said that?
It says.
That's all it said, because the way this thing is drafted, we're going to cut out of a lot of other people. believe it or not, the Humane Society does political action stuff. They are involved in politics, and they would be included in this bill.
And they don't help people, they help dogs.
They help dogs, right?
Yeah.
They don't help
and we can stick some in here about society, you know, societies that prevent cruelty to animals, if, you know, that to take care of them, because that's charitable in a historical sense. This amendment that I've got here changes what you just said, which is that if they engage in any political activity at all, they're excluded. I recognize that as a problem. I've got a LC draft of an amendment that fixes that problem so that if an organization like United Way has a lobbyist on retainer in Salem, like they do, that's incidental to their primary purpose, and it would not exclude them from participating.
Okay, we have Representative Mannix and Representative Repine.
Federal government has had this issue in front of it. I don't know if you've had a chance to get that information. It would be helpful if you could and share it with us, but they've even had litigation in regard to their charitable checkoff system, and they've had access litigation based on discrimination against organizations. I wasn't focused on it because I wasn't dealing with this legislation, but I'm aware that they've had substantial litigation in the federal courts about groups that were excluded from the federal charitable giving program. It seems to me, and I'd like your reaction to this, I would rather have government go all one way or all another. That is, set up a system where you just say, people, if there's at least 50 employees who want to contribute to an organization, I'm not going to make any value judgment. I may make them pay the freight through some small fee for having a checkoff option at all. But I get nervous about the government starting to make value judgments. I was only half kidding. If there's 50 employees who want to give to the Ku Klux Klan, and 500 who want to give to the ACLU, and 300 who want to give to their church through a checkoff plan, as long as the government is not subsidizing that is, if they have to pay the cost of the checkoff program, it seems to me that Representative Edmondson's point is not have a screen door, a filter, but either you close the door and you say no checkoffs at all, or you open it and say, folks, as long as there's enough people to make it work for any given organization, we'll let you do it, but you've got to pay for it. Wouldn't that take care of the concern about government subsidizing the activity of any organization and just say, well, we're not going to subsidize it because they're going to pay the freight?
Well, that's a policy decision we can make, certainly, if we want to just stop the deduction system entirely and save some money, like Sam says. That's a policy decision we can make. That was not my intent in this bill. My intent was to simply go back to... See, this law has been in effect a long time and worked just fine for a long time when all it did was raise money for charitable organizations. Then through the back door and through a agreement that was settled behind closed doors with the state executive department, all of a sudden we've got a situation where the historical charitable situation has been expanded to where we have a bunch of political organizations.
Interestingly enough.
I'm just trying to take it back the way it was with this bill.
The current law never authorized that. It just said any employee can request a deposit to an account, and the payroll officer will make the deposit. And over time, apparently, there's evolved a system where that request for deposits has included a specific designation of charitable organizations.
It's not shown on my bill, but the previous section in the statute is 292.045, and that's the one that says the state is authorized to do this payroll system for United Fund, and that's United Fund is actually in the statute. So that tells you how old it is, because they don't call it United Fund anymore. It's United Way now.
Community. Go ahead.
Let's form United.
Representative Repine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rod, do you believe that maybe another way to approach this is, well, first of all, I was going to ask you a question. What do you know what it takes to qualify to get on the checkoff list on the state tax return?
I'm sorry.
Do you know what it takes to get on?
Mm-hmm. There's a form here. That's filled out by the, I believe this is the one that's filled out by the employees.
No, I meant, what does it take to become a qualifying, one of those five agencies that are listed?
As far as the actual detailed application requirements, I'm not familiar with those, other than that in general, it's been opened up to where anybody can walk in and show that they have a 501c3 status with the Federal Internal Revenue Code can qualify.
Those five agencies that you list, I think, are listed actually by name on the document.
It could be, Representative Repine, and I'd I would defer to, I know Art James of the Executive Department is here, and I think he may have more information about the details on those questions.
And the only reason I bring that up, Mr. Chairman, and to you, Mr. Johnson, is I remember last session getting involved in some other debate for some other groups that wanted to get on to some kind of checkoff or contribution, and it really came down to the not the issue of the merits of the organization or the substance of what they were going to do, is the fact that there was limited space on the form, and you can only print so many words, and you can only print so small, and so that became somewhat more of a criteria of who shall and who shall not be on the tax return. On the payroll, on the card. Mr. Johnson, do you believe that possibly another way of attacking this is to establish a percentage of contribution that is deemed to be charitable by these people? In other words, say that of the dollars that are raised via this vehicle or this checkoff, that a percentage of it has to be shown and traceable back to a charitable participation, be it ministry, be it food or shelter. Would that be another way of doing this?
In the organization's records, it would prove that it only spent most of its money on charitable activities. I'm trying to do that with this amendment, which uses the word incidental to try to draw that line, so that I considered sticking in an organization that can prove it didn't spend more than 5% on political activities, for example, can qualify. I refrain from putting a specific number in there, choosing to go with the word incidental instead, because it would be most of these organizations are clearly either charitable, like United Way, or political, like 1,000 Friends of Oregon, which happens to be on the list of the Environmental Federation people. 1,000 Friends doesn't do anything except get involved in political stuff, and so that it's easy to get involved, to draw a line between those two. And if you get back to where there's an organization that's mostly charitable but does a little bit of political, for example, Association of Retired Citizens, Retarded Citizens, if it lobbies a little bit for the rights of retarded people, but its main function is to serve retarded people, then that should be allowed, and that shouldn't be, since their primary purpose is to help people, then we should go ahead and let them participate. But so I wanted it to be a flexible thing a little bit there. Mr. Chair, I would like to respond to Kevin, Representative Mannix's point about the federal litigation. It went to the Supreme Court on and was decided on July 2nd, 1985, in a case called Cornelius versus NAACP. And the rule that came down was that as to the federal system, it's okay to draw a line among all of the potential 501c3 type people out there, as long as you do it on a viewpoint neutral basis. For example, you couldn't exclude NAACP and let Ku Klux Klan in there, for example, because that might not be viewpoint neutral. What this bill does, my bill does, which by the way, we're looking at federal legislation that's been interpreted by the Supreme Court, but for our purposes, we're assuming that would at least be used as reference, if not binding law on this issue. As long as what we're doing in charitable is allowing any charity, no matter what it works on, if it's serving people in need or providing human services, that's viewpoint neutral on that side. On the other side, we're excluding all political activities, which are, regardless of whether it's NAACP or Ku Klux Klan, we're excluding them both, or we're excluding Republicans, we're excluding Democrats. We're viewpoint neutral on that side. It's not a viewpoint neutral problem between charitable versus political. So we're in compliance with the federal Supreme Court, and Kathleen Buffet is available to give you that formal opinion.
I didn't suggest that you were out of compliance. I'm just trying to look at another approach. Mr. Chairman, one other question?
Yeah, one more, and then we need to get on.
Well, this will be more of a suggestion than a question, and maybe people could chew on it. Shouldn't we just go to a system where we say any organization that wants to be eligible for payroll deduction will pay, say, $500 to the state for the cost of the state to distribute to employees biannually a list of organizations that wish to be up for contributions? No judgment value about the organization. And that any employee can designate, say, up to 10 organizations that will receive a deduction. But for the privilege of making any deduction, the employee pays $1 per paycheck. Most state employees are paid on a monthly basis. I'd know that I could designate 10 organizations. And then we say that if at least 100 people haven't designated a given organization, then they are not eligible for participation during that year or that six-month period, probably yearly.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe half of their deposit will be refunded to them, but they'll have to have lost $250 for taking a shot at it. The employees are all given access to a system of charitable giving or political contributions. They get to make the choice. You put a price on it, so government's not subsidizing it. It seems to me then it's content neutral. And by the way, I would like to see some people able to give to their church if they want to, if we're going to let people give it all. You want to just think about that?
Yeah, as I said before, that would be better than it is now, in that we wouldn't be subsidizing it anymore.
We've got some other people who want to testify. We're going to take a 5-minute break, and we're going to come back and have the testimony. Michael, do you want to come up and testify? Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Tedesco, and I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent labor organizations and have for the past 10 years, and I'm here specifically on behalf of my client, the Oregon School Employees Association. And I'd like to address my comments to Bill 3385. A couple of things stand out in rereading this, and the first thing is that the line to be drawn between political and charitable is a wavery line at best. In fact, I think that it's a line that frankly cannot be joined. One person's charity is another person's political organization, and vice versa, depending upon what side of the fence you are on a particular issue. And I note the amendment that Representative Johnson has put into this bill to try to clarify that, but I suggest to you that it will be the source of litigation in the future, because that line is a very difficult line to draw. The other comment I would make is that there is an opportunity to accomplish some of the things that this committee has just discussed, specifically Representative Mannix's concept of some sort of pay-as-you-go system, and that can be put in place through the collective bargaining process. Now, I have, over the last 10 years, reviewed hundreds of public sector collective bargaining labor agreements. And frankly, I have yet seen that issue come up or even be raised, frankly, from the management side, which suggests to me that perhaps the problem isn't nearly as great as maybe we're devoting to it today. And it also suggests to me that maybe it's an idea whose time has come. There's nothing to prohibit management in a labor relations context under state collective bargaining laws to suggest an idea such as Representative Mannix has suggested here today. And that, from my point of view, would be infinitely preferable to setting up a system of legislation which tries to draw a distinction between charitable and political, which I don't believe can be drawn. So if there is a problem, let it be raised at the collective bargaining table, and we'll deal with it that way. You've got a very good collective bargaining law in this state that works. It handles a variety of problems, many of them a lot more complex than this. And I think we got to owe it to them to give it a shot, as opposed to drafting legislation, which I can guarantee you will be subject to litigation for years on end as to what's charitable and what's political.
Okay, any questions? Mm-hmm. You know, I think Representative Mannix suggested that there should be a charge or an amount that someone has to pay in order to get on the list. Is that what you...
Well, I heard a number of brainstorming, if I can use that term, of who pays and how much they pay and when they pay. And I don't take any particular position on whether that's appropriate or not. All I'm saying is if management has concerns about the cost of implementing payroll deduction, that get raised at the collective bargaining table with... Look, I can tell you from having negotiated labor agreements, management is not shy about telling us when we on the union side is costing them money. And I would have thought that if this were had any financial impact at all, that in 10 years of doing this, I would have heard management at some point try to raise that issue, and I've not yet heard it.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming today. David, we have Terry Witt.
Thank you, sir.
Are you doing?
Yeah.
Josie testified.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, thank you. My name is Terry Witt, and I'm the Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We're a grassroots organization which supports forestry, agriculture, and the use of agricultural chemicals. We have collectively represent more than 20,000 Oregonians. We are here today in support of the concepts in House Bill 3385. And as you've been made aware, there are some problems that need to be corrected with the language, but I think perhaps some of those problems can be worked out. In specific, we are concerned about the abuse of the system, the state system of annual combined charitable contribution program, and that is the expansion of that program to include what we would not consider to be traditional charitable organizations. And that program has been opened up basically following rule changes in 1989 and again in 1990, but we believe those changes went well beyond what was needed to fix the problems that were brought to bear by challenge from the Black United Fund. Instead of just opening up the program to other true charities, the rules were substantially amended, allowing all organizations access based solely upon a 501c3 tax status, along with some other minor requirements in terms of forming federations and being filed with the state. We believe these are contradictory to the intent of the combined charitable contributions program. And I think if one looks...